Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
America has changed a lot since the passage of the Immigration and Naturalization Act in 1965, in ways that have inspired some and unsettled others. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Before we dropped the old system of national quotas 50 years ago, 75% of U.S. immigrants hailed from places in Europe. Today, 90% come from outside Europe, enriching American culture and complicating American politics with new arrivals from Asia, Latin America, Africa, and the Middle East. The story of why we changed our immigration policies and how the results differed from what the architects of those changes expected is a fascinating one and sheds light on conversations about immigration reform that we are having today. Tom Gelton is here to explain. You know him as a longtime correspondent for NPR. He's also the author of a new book called A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. Tom, welcome back to Think.
Chris, it's good to be with you again.
We may be a nation of people with immigrant roots, but the percentage of Americans born abroad has varied widely at different moments in our history. At the time of the passage of the Immigration and Naturalization Act, it had pretty much slowed to a crawl.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one of the reasons for that is that U.S. immigration policy was really, really disproportionately biased in favor of Europeans and against people of other nationalities. And the truth is that by 1965, fewer people in Europe were interested in immigrating to the United States. Europe had been a huge source of immigration to the United States in the late 19th century and early 20th century, when the foreign-born share of the U.S. population was so high. But by 1965, Europe was doing pretty well. It had recovered from the war, and the countries were prospering, and there was just no more reason for many Europeans to come here. So naturally, that flow from Europe trickled. And because it was so hard for anybody else to come, your immigrants from Europe were not replaced by a new wave of immigration from Asia, Africa, and other parts of the world. So, it was only after the doors were opened to these other nationalities that we saw immigration turn back up again.
Most people have heard stories of the waves of immigration that happened to the United States in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Why did the country, as you say, throw those doors wide open to such large numbers then? And then what was the backlash that caused them to close, if not all the way, to just a crack?
Well, this is interesting. It wasn't a fear of people of color. It was not the fear of Asian hordes or African immigrants or Muslims from the Middle East. It was a fear that they were getting too many Southern Europeans, too many Italians, too many Greeks, too many Slavs, too many Jews. That was actually the big issue. And if you read what was written about the immigrant population, it was full of very nasty stuff about Southern Europeans and Eastern Europeans. The big concern was not, people from other parts of the world. And interestingly enough, at the time the 65 Act was passed, the big support for it, particularly people like John Kennedy and other Northeast members of Congress from the Northeast, they were pushing for more opportunities for Italians and Greeks and Eastern Europeans to immigrate. It's like almost nobody really considered that the beneficiaries ultimately would be people from Asia and Africa and the Middle East.
Without really thinking very hard about it, I suppose we culturally defined ourselves in terms of our ties to Europe. If we were not a legal colony of some kind, we were still kind of a cultural colony.
Absolutely. And this is one of the interesting things. I mean, my book is titled A Nation of Nations, which is taken from a poem that Walt Whitman wrote in it, I think, 1850s. And the truth is, he had this beautiful language about how the United States is not merely a nation, but a teeming nation of nations. The truth is, we were not a nation of nations at that time. We were a European country. It was, the vast majority of people here had immigrated from Europe, and that was sort of implicitly the idea. When the Statue of Liberty was built at the end of the 19th century, where did it face? It faced across the Atlantic to Europe. There's no Statue of Liberty on the West Coast. So even though we had this mythology that we were a country open to everyone, sort of the unspoken, implicit assumption was that only Europeans would come, and that we were really a European country, a European nation. And even during the debate over the 1965 Act, you saw members of Congress basically articulating this, that that the United States is a European country, an Anglo-Saxon country. That's an echo that we hear even today, you know, that fundamentally we are either a Christian nation or a Judeo-Christian nation. You know, there's still some people that haven't accustomed to the fact that, you know, essentially the idea of America, even from the very beginning, is that it was supposed to be a country where people from all backgrounds could come.
It's worth pointing out, by the way, that we didn't really have immigration laws until the latter part of the 19th century.
Well, that's true. I mean, the I guess there wasn't a need for immigration laws prior to that time. There was no sort of immigration pattern from Africa or Asia, with the exception of Chinese workers who were coming to work first on the Transcontinental Railroad and then in mines and so forth. And it was only when we began to see large numbers of people coming in from areas of the world that we weren't comfortable receiving people from, and specifically that would include Chinese, only then did you see that was there a sort of a need, a felt need, to enact some immigration restrictions. That's one thing. The other thing is that the United States in the 19th century was largely an empty country. I mean, there were vast territories that were unpopulated, and America needed foreigners to come and work in factories or farm. And so that's another reason why there wasn't a sort of this great need to restrict immigration. All of those things changed, you know, at the turn of the 20th century. You know, finally, the numbers began to strike some people as excessive. And there were nativists who were beginning to be concerned that we were getting the wrong kind of immigrants. Those were some of the factors that explained the introduction in 1924 of the national origin quota system.
And this basically set up, quotas, numbers that could come from specific countries, and Northern and Western Europe were heavily favored there.
Right. And that was a deliberate attempt to maintain the U.S. population with that particular character. It's unbelievable some of the things that were written around that time, how, you know, there was talk about superior races. And not superior races in the sense of the Caucasians being superior over, you know, what they called Orientals or African races. The Scandinavian race was considered to be superior to the Italian race. I mean, the term race was thrown around a lot more loosely at that time. And, you know, there was pseudoscientific is the proper term, literature written about how certain nationalities were genetically superior to other nationalities. And they didn't even get into the issue of Africans and Asians. They were talking about different European nationalities.
That strikes us now as so ridiculous and laughable. Why doesn't it strike many people that it's ridiculous and laughable to have the same kinds of concerns about people coming from, East Asia and Africa?
Well, I think one difference is that, Italians and Slavs were, even though they were from a different part of Europe, they were still Christian, they were still European, they were still white. So the differences were less pronounced than the differences are today, where you have immigrants coming in with a different religious background, whether it's Muslim or Buddhist or Hindu, immigrants coming in, with a different skin color. So the differences are more pronounced. And so I think that, you know, people today can sort of justify their concern about the dilution of what they consider to be the American character with the introduction of these other nationalities. But I largely take a pretty positive view of American history in this book. I mean, I think that the 50 years of experience incorporating people of different backgrounds since 1965 have been largely a pretty successful time in terms of our ability as a society to integrate people of different backgrounds, people who we hadn't integrated before. I think largely, you know, this has been an encouraging story that has demonstrated America's resilience as a society. But there do continue to be concerns, anxiety, fear of people who are different from the dominant culture.
My guest is NPR correspondent Tom Gelton, author of the new book, A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. We'll resume our conversation in a few minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with NPR correspondent Tom Gelton, author of A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. Join us at 800-933-5372. So, Tom, the 1960s were this time of extraordinary turmoil and also extraordinary idealism in America. How did discussions begin about the need to overhaul immigration policy?
They dated back to 1952, when the McCarran-Walter Act was passed, which reinforced the national origin quota system. President Truman gave an eloquent veto, he vetoed that act, and gave a very eloquent explanation for why this was un-American. And there was a commission that was established as a result of the passage of that act to look at U.S. immigration policy. The title of that commission, they put out a report that was called Whom We Shall Welcome. That actually came from a speech by George Washington in which he said, "The bosom of America is open not only to the opulent and respectable stranger, but the oppressed and persecuted of all nations and religions, whom we shall welcome." I don't remember the exact words, according to whether they accept, willing to behave decently, et cetera. Mm. So that notion, whom we shall welcome, was sort of the principle that for more than 200 years was held out as an ideal. Whom shall we welcome? And this commission sort of laid out a new policy, a new policy that would have included the elimination of these national origin quotas, basically set the agenda. It wasn't until 13 years later that that agenda was actually fulfilled, but this was very vigorously debated throughout the 1950s and in the 1960s as you say, idealism was sort of gaining a foothold. One other factor, there was a portion of this that wasn't really so much to do with the idealism of the time. That was also the Cold War. And there was fear that, there was this fear of communism that infused much of our thinking about policy issues. And there was a concern that this national origin quota system, because it was so blatantly racist and ethnocentric, was hurting America's image in parts of the world that were vulnerable to Soviet propaganda. So there was a Cold War argument that was made at the same time that we needed to change our immigration policy so the communists would not take advantage of that and sort of taint America's image. Various kind of factors came together in the 1960s that galvanized enough support in Congress to bring this about.
So there were these fascinating debates over how to structure the terms of, you know, the qualifications that prospective immigrants needed to have, and in particular, how we would do something that's called a chain migration. Tell us about those.
That's one of the sort of the untold stories of this act. The original version of the 65 Act, as proposed by first the Kennedy administration, then the Johnson administration, and by Senator Philip Hart of Michigan and Congressman Emanuel Seller from Brooklyn, not only threw out the national origin quotas, but also had to propose new guidelines for who shall get visas. I mean, it wasn't as though the United States was going to open its doors to anybody who wanted to come. So there had to be priorities of who would get visas. And the top preference was for those candidates who had skills or training that were considered, quote, especially advantageous, unquote, unquote, to the United States. And the idea was, and President Johnson said in his 1964 State of the Union address, that it is perfectly appropriate to ask a potential immigrant, what can you do for our country? We should not ask in what country you were born. But the first part of that quote is very important. He was saying that immigrants should be chosen according to what they can do for the country. What can they offer the country? There was some concern among, and there were people who defended the national origins quotas, who said that, you know, as we've been discussing, that America is essentially a European country and should stay that way. And if it takes national origin quotas to keep it that way, so be it. When they recognized that the national origin quotas were probably going to be that there was enough support to get rid of them, you know, there was some creative thinking about what could be done to immigration policy without national origin quotas that would accomplish the same thing. In other words, that would ensure that most of the immigrants coming in were white Europeans. And the idea was that instead of favoring immigrants who had skills and training that were advantageous to the United States, why not favor immigrants who already had family members here, who had relatives here? So the principle was family unification. Priority would be given to those immigrants who would be unifying their families here. That ultimately was the top priority passed as a result of the 65 Act. And it was a compromise. It was a compromise that was engineered in order to get more support for this, to win the support of some conservatives who were nervous that the ethnic profile of the population was going to change. So that was a very important change in the law. And what the people didn't realize is that by prioritizing family unification, you were imposing rules that would favor what you said, chain migration. In fact, there was a new category that was introduced in the law as a result of that amendment, and that would set aside something like a quarter of all visas for brothers and sisters of naturalized U.S. citizens. So if you had a immigrant who came in, perhaps, let's say, as a student, or maybe a Korean woman who came, married a U.S. serviceman, and therefore became naturalized, under the 65 Act, she could then bring in her adult brothers and sisters and their families, their spouses. Those spouses, in turn, once they're naturalized, could bring in their brothers and sisters. So, you know, one of the nicknames for this 65 Act was the Brothers and Sisters Act. Nobody recognized at the time that they were setting the stage for an exponentially increasing chain migration. It was one of the great miscalculations behind this law. This is why the law had unintended consequences. And the irony is that brothers and sisters provision, for example, was put in there by people who thought that by doing so, they were going to be replicating the national origins of the current U.S. population. It was a strategy that totally backfired and produced exactly the opposite result of what they were looking for.
It's given us the America we have today.
It has. It has. But as a result of that, we have a lot more immigrants than we expected we were going to have as a result of this act.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Teresa in Plano. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I'm glad you've had this guest on here to explain things. This is, what I have learned in college, and I read books on my own because I was very interested in the subject. From the very beginning, the origins of this country, it was the English. They wanted only English culture and English people. And then that's why they restricted immigration for a long time to Eastern Europeans or Southern Europeans. And they saw them as very different, like your guest was saying. And also, it's very similar to the current trend now, especially like a lot of Republicans now arguing that, you know, allowing this many people, say, from Latino countries to come here, I have heard them on the radio saying that these people are underlings. These are people that are not educated. We don't want to fill up America, you know, with such people. And also the color is another thing, too. You know, you've got the in culture promoting the books, the browning of America. We want to avoid that. So it's more about fear of race or fear of a another group taking over the white population. And I think that with all the hybridization, the mixing of cultures, mixing of different races, intermarrying, I think that it's going to change no matter what. And I think we will eventually become, you know, like the United Nations, but it will be still America. And
Well, thank you so much for your call, Teresa. Is there anything there you want to comment on, Tom?
Well, there's one thing that Teresa said at the beginning, which I think is really interesting, and that is that the idea of the other, the idea of people who are different as somehow being inferior, has changed over time. And as she implied, it has sort of grown. Under the national origin quota system, Germans were very heavily favored. But Benjamin Franklin, writing back in the 18th century, complained that German immigrants are, quote, generally of the most ignorant, stupid sort of their own nation. So prejudice against foreigners may now be, you know, against people of color, but in Benjamin Franklin's time, it was against Germans. Later, it was against the Irish. It was against Italians. I mean, the sort of the circle of who is not favored was very broad in the beginning, and now it has narrowed and narrowed and narrowed, and now we're basically just, you know, there's prejudice against immigrants of color now. No longer is there prejudice against Italian or Polish immigrants or German immigrants, but, you know, that was not the case. So we have a long history in this country of being very nervous about people who are different. It's just the idea of who's different has changed.
I remember when I was a kid, my Irish-American grandfather talking about bias against Latino immigrants and saying, you know, this is their time to be sort of persecuted, and our people were, you know, decades ago. Understanding that I'm not arguing for marginalizing any group of immigrants, do you think there is something to the sort of process of being fully accepted in America that many groups will have to endure this moment in time where they are treated as if they're not wanted?
Well, that certainly is the historical lesson. I mean, it's, you know, as I say, this has been the case for basically every immigrant group that has come into the country. And what happens is that they get acculturated, they get integrated, and it becomes moot. I mean, nobody talks about the assimilability of Italians anymore or of Jews. They were talking about that in the beginning of the 20th century. And if that pattern continues, you know, 50 years from now, no one will be talking about the assimilability of Hispanic immigrants or Asian immigrants or people from the Middle East. I mean, that it would seem that that's sort of what happens.
My guest is NPR correspondent Tom Gelton. His new book is called A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. You can be part of the conversation by calling 800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with NPR correspondent Tom Gelton, whose new book is called A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. Join us at 800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Tom, you profile a number of families in this book, people from Bolivia and South Korea and Libya. Were you struck by the common threads among these people who had such diverse backgrounds, such diverse countries of origin?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in each case, there was consistency in terms of what motivated their decision to come here. You know, it's in each case, I think that they were attracted by the idea of opportunity in America and the chance to make a fresh start and get somewhere, opportunities that were, for one reason or another, lacking in their home countries. On the other hand, I also saw a lot of diversity in sort of their experiences. I chose these families quite deliberately because I wanted to highlight different issues. I wanted to highlight the political implications of this changing demography. I wanted to highlight the question of whether what the economic impact of immigration is. You know, one of the interesting things I was looking at was for immigrants who were especially enterprising. The act of immigrating itself can be seen as an entrepreneurial act in the sense of there being a high risk up front for the expectation of a reward later on. That is the classic definition of an entrepreneurial venture. So I was interested in exploring, you know, whether these people are more entrepreneurial than perhaps native-born Americans. I was interested in the cultural issues involved in the incorporation of different populations. I chose very deliberately a Muslim family because I wanted to know what it was like in this sort of post 9/11 period for Muslim immigrants coming to the United States. So, to me, they represent a real variety of experiences. But yeah, I did find commonality between them in terms of their decision not only to migrate here, but in the way that they sort of saw themselves becoming more attached to America than they may even have thought they would be in the beginning.
You mentioned demographics. What's interesting is that many people listening to our conversation might have generations ago had a first-generation relative land in a big city, maybe in some kind of densely populated urban enclave. A lot of immigrants today move rather quickly to suburban regions.
Yeah, that's a new phenomenon. There's a sociologists have identified a number of these suburban areas that seem to be sort of favored by immigrants, and they're called edge gateways. They are often on the edges of metropolitan areas, partly because housing prices are lower the further out you go, but also because schools are often better out in the distant suburbs. They're safer, but immigrants seem to be choosing a little bit more deliberately where they settle than they did in the past. And they're making those decisions on a sort of family-by-family individual basis, rather than choosing, you know, if you're, say, an immigrant from Korea, rather than choosing a neighborhood where all the other Koreans live, you know, you're going to choose whatever neighborhood appeals to you personally. So you see a more dispersed pattern of immigrant settlement. We don't see nearly the enclave phenomenon that we saw, let's say, 100 years ago. You don't have Chinatowns, Little Italys, that kind of thing that we used to have. I focus on Fairfax County in Northern Virginia. In Fairfax County, there is one apparent enclave. It's called Koreatown. But what I found when I went into Koreatown, which is Annandale, is that Hispanics dominated that community. It's Koreatown because that seems to be the shopping center for Koreans. But Koreans weren't living there. They were scattered throughout the county.
Of course, that has meant some fast adjustment for some of these communities that at one point, quite frankly, were founded by people engaging in white flight, looking for a life for their families that didn't have so much diversity.
Well, if that was their intent in moving there, they are apparently disappointed because Fairfax County has turned out to be one of the most diverse counties anywhere in the United States. But what's interesting to me is that it has consistently, for about the last 10 or 15 years, been one of the one, two, or three most wealthy counties in the United States. So, you know, for people who feared that more diversity would sort of bring the per capita income down or lead to a decline in public services or sort of the livability quotient of the area going down. You know, the experience of Fairfax County has shown that, you know, this is a county that has gone from being 3% immigrant in 1970 to 30% immigrant in 2010. So in that 40-year period, The Fairfax County incorporated a huge number of foreign-born people, and yet that is precisely the period in which it became one of the wealthiest counties in the United States with a very strong school system, very strong local government. So there appears that there's no contradiction between a more diverse population and prosperity and good governance.
How are today's immigrants moving toward political involvement and activism? And how does it differ with maybe what happened, you know, 50 or 75 years ago when new immigrants would arrive?
I didn't get into so much of a historical analysis of that, so I can't answer the last part of your question. I do think that one thing that we've seen, for whatever reason, and I don't have the explanation for this, we actually see lower voting rates among immigrant groups than among native-born population. Asian and Hispanic immigrants, even after they have become naturalized as U.S. citizens and have the right to vote, tend to vote at somewhat lower rates than native-born people. Now, one reason maybe that they're so focused on sort of gaining a foothold in society and learning the language and getting skills that they just are sort of pay less attention to politics. Maybe they're sort of less confident about their understanding of the American political system. I don't have the answer to that. It's something that sort of distresses a lot of the leaders of those communities because they really want to, they promote empowerment of those communities. And there's a lot of work being undertaken to sort of raise those rates. I do think that one of the things that we see is that the more candidates that you have from various immigrant groups, the more likely those voting rates are going to go up. You know, there is diversity of the population is not matched by the diversity of political representation. You don't, you know, Asians can be, are very, very well represented in Fairfax County, for example. But in the Virginia State Legislature, we only have one Asian American immigrant, and he's the only, he's actually profiled in my book, mm-hmm. Markeem, is the only Asian American immigrant in 400 years in the Virginia State Legislature, in spite of the fact that there are all these immigrants. So, but in his particular case, in his particular constituency, you know, the fact that he ran for office has attracted a lot more interest on the part of his fellow Asian Americans. So one way that you would get sort of participation rates to go up is if you could recruit more candidates from those immigrant groups to themselves run for office. I think that this has all changing, Chris. I think that, you know, sort of the past trends may not be the future trends. And one factor that may contribute here is whether these groups feel that they are being demonized in some way. You know, that mm-hmm. might motivate them to get out and vote more. And, you know, we may be seeing some of that phenomenon right now. But, you know, it's obviously a complicated issue.
How did your people get to America?
My own family?
Yes, the Jeltons and related family members.
Right. Well, we're all, you know, except for Native Americans and African Americans, we're all immigrants. And, you know, if you go back far enough, you're going to be able to tell that story. My family is somewhat more recent. I'm third generation, which means that my grandparents immigrated here. They came from Norway. One grandparent came from England, but three quarters of them came from Norway. And, you know, one of the things that I have found is that their motivation was no different than the motivation of people coming from Central America. My mother's father grew up on a farm in Norway, and there is a primogeniture law, or was a primogeniture law in Norway, which they didn't want to have the farmland broken up into little parcels. So only one son could inherit a family farm. And if you had a large family, that meant all the other sons, the younger sons, they didn't get the farm. They had to find something else to do. And in the late 19th century, when my mother's father immigrated here, there wasn't much to do. You know, in those years, believe it or not, because I don't think that people from non-Scandinavian backgrounds realize this, Norway, for example, was losing 5% of its population every year during a period, precisely because it was a pre-industrial economy and there just weren't employment opportunities. So, you know, they had no option but to migrate, and migrate they did. What's the difference between that and a Salvadoran peasant who sees no future in El Salvador or Guatemala, or somebody from Bolivia, which is another place that I write about in this book? What's the difference between them not seeing opportunity in their country and choosing to migrate, and the decision of my grandparents to migrate because they saw no opportunity in their country? The difference is that they came at a different time. My grandparents came at the turn of the century, and they have a different skin color. They were white European, and therefore were sort sort of more welcomed in this society than immigrants of color have been. But, you know, in terms of their motivation and experience, it was actually very consistent.
Tom Gelton is a correspondent for NPR and author of the new book, A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. Tom, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us today.
It's been really fun, Chris.
Thanks.